I think we'll go ahead and get started while we're waiting for a few people to join. The time is 8:32 a.m. on June 2nd, 2023, and I call the meeting of the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners to order. This meeting is video hosted using Zoom. The public and parties on this agenda have been properly noticed of this fact and have been supplied with the meeting access instructions. Ms. Poe, would you please begin with a roll call?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Davey?
Present.
Dr. Meyer?
Present.
Mr. Dinar? Mr. Dinar? I'll come back to Mr. Dinar.
He's trying to unmute.
Dr. Davis Wilson?
Present.
Dr. Catarino?
Present.
Dr. Medina? Dr. Malott?
Present.
Dr. Stewart?
Present.
Mr. Nguyen?
Present.
Mr. Dinar? Let me see if I can unmute him. Don't think I can.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. Thank you. Mr. Dinar is present. We have a quorum.
Thank you. And Mr. Dinar, we're aware you're calling in as well as Ms. Galvin. And so we have you both as on the phone. Thank you. Very good. Please note that any time stated on the agenda are approximate. The board makes every effort to begin proceedings at the scheduled time. The board may suspend the discussion of one agenda item, proceed to a timed item, and then return to a former agenda item at a later time. The board may also reorder non-timed items. Board members, thank you very much for my proactive praise, and thanks for you using the raise hand feature today, as there's many people on the call, and as we kind of want to be able to manage and allow everyone to speak and provide comments and questions, please do use that feature the best of your ability. I do understand those on the phone, Mr. Dinar and Ms. Galvin, if you need to interject, please just go ahead and interrupt at an appropriate time, and I will put you in the queue to be able to join the conversation. The board encourages everyone in attendance today to provide feedback by completing the board assessment form. You'll find the link on the meeting agenda that is posted on the board's website. I'd like to move just to some recognitions as we do prior to our meetings, you know, particularly the board members for all of your hard work. Thank you so much for coming to each and every one of these meetings and our subcommittee meetings prepared and well-versed in the issues that we'll be tackling for the day. Just want to go and continue to say that we appreciate your time and effort. That also goes same efforts there for the board staff, for our board attorney, that just keep us, you know, fully abreast of all information. They provide us, you know, updates as things are moving, even in, you know, up until the last moments before we start this meeting, things are often moving around. You all do that with such grace and clarity. Just thank you for that, and we greatly appreciate it. Attendance to this board meeting is eligible for continuing education credit if it's at least 4 hours long. Should its duration be 4 hours or more, please make note of the code words provided throughout the meeting. To report the code words to the board staff for the purpose of earning continuing education credit, please look for the link on the board's meeting page for this particular meeting. It is possible that today's meeting will not be 4 hours in duration, but thank you for your understanding ahead of time. Next, we'll move to call to the public. Those wishing to address the board do not need to request permission in advance. However, the board will limit the number of persons speaking during this time to a reasonable number on any public comment matter. In addition, each person wishing to address the board will be given 3 minutes to do so. Pursuant to ARS 38431.02H, the board can only take actions on matters listed on the agenda. The board members may not discuss the matter with each other or with the member of the public addressing the board. The only option available is to instruct staff to place the topic on a future agenda if applicable. If you wish to speak, please unmute your line, state your name, and I will call on you. Board staff, I believe you've noted that there is no one who has informed us prior, so it does not sound like we have anybody from the public wishing to address us today. So we'll move on to item number 5 of the agenda. That is our council update. Ms. Galvin, I know you're on the phone. We'll give you a chance to unmute and let us know if you have any update for us. I will let...
Thank you, Mr. President.
Yes.
This is Jean Galvin. Thank you. I do not have an update at this time.
Thank you so much for that, Ms. Galvin. Appreciate that. We'll now move on to the consent agenda, discussion, consideration, and possible action. Agenda item 6, for the record, are there any recusals for items on the consent agenda for any of the board members? All right, hearing none. Dr. Davis-Wilson, I think I gave you time to unmute. I don't think there was anybody the last time from the behavior analyst applications that you needed to recuse from. Okay, so I think we're good on that. Any board members may wish to request to remove an item from the consent agenda for independent discussion and action. Are there any such requests from the board? Hearing none, if there are no requests to remove an item, is there a motion to approve the items on the consent agenda?
Mr. Chair, may I interject just with a clarification, a non-substantive correction? The applicant at C2E, Dr. Khalsa, was placed in the wrong category for his application. He should be listed under 3, requesting approval for licensure by waiver. That being said, this is not a preclusion to him qualifying for licensure. ARC affirmed that he's met the requirements. It's simply an administrative error that we want noted for the record. So that doesn't change the board's action on the consent agenda. It just, you know, we need the record to show that we need to indicate in his record that he's licensed by waiver.
Thank you for that.
I'd make a motion to approve the consent agenda.
Second.
Very good. First from Dr. Catarino, a second from Dr. Stewart. Any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Very good. Motion carries. Actually, I should ask. Any opposed? Any objections, recusals? No, very good. Motion carries. Don't want to get ahead of myself. Make sure there's nothing crazy going on there. I do believe that we're going to exercise our ability to kind of move some things around on the agenda, if I'm correct, Ms. Pakanan, and that we had discussed moving to item number 11 related to recommendations from the Committee on Behavior Analysts at this point. Is that correct? All right, Dr. Davis-Wilson, do you want to take a moment to unmute yourself? And we will get flipped to that page. All right, we're going to move on to number 11, discussion, consideration, possible action relating to the Committee on Behavior Analysts, a recommendation regarding to the following complaints and our initial case review for the following complaints. Complaint number 2325 is Dawn Wadsworth. Agenda item 11, A, B, and C, all consist of recommendations for case dispositions that were reviewed by the Committee on Behavior Analysts on May 30th. Dr. Davis-Wilson is going to provide a summary on 11A and the recommendation from the board.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is complaint number 2325 involving Ms. Dawn Wadsworth. The committee has reviewed all of the materials before us. Ms. Wadsworth was reported by her former employer as potentially abandoning or leaving clients without a proper transition plan. Ms. Wadsworth did supply quite a bit of documentation around her attempts to remediate some ethical concerns that she had with her employer and her attempts to provide some solutions to some of the concerns that she had with the service provision at her employment site. She did acknowledge that upon departure, there was adequate supervision and additional staffing to take over the cases. Ms. Wadsworth's former employer was present for the committee review and did express concerns that there was not any transition plan that included whether or not these families were aware of the transition or giving any time for Ms. Wadsworth to provide a transition meeting to another behavior analyst. During the committee review, again, it was noted that Ms. Wadsworth was between her own ethical dilemma of what she felt was proper services executed by the employer, as well as her need to transition services accordingly. When the committee reviewed the complaint, we originally had additional questions both for the employer, but also in regard to documentation specific to the treatment plans. We requested that information and found that the treatment plans were sufficient for another individual to pick up those plans. It was further disclosed during the committee meeting that there were additional supervisors that were familiar with the case and familiar with the programming. After the review, the committee did express the concerns that perhaps giving little to no notice to an employer when you do have a caseload is problematic. But we did struggle to find it rising to a statutory level of concern. And we have recommended before the board today a non-disciplinary letter of concern with a order for continuing education. The continuing education has been completed. And so that that end of the deal has been met, and Ms. Wadsworth is aware that those hours are not able to count towards licensure renewal. And that concludes my summary at this time.
Thank you, Dr. Davis Wilson. Are there any questions from board members? Hearing none, Ms. Wadsworth, are you and your attorney present? I'm looking at my screen here.
Yeah, good morning. This is Jeff Hunter,
counsel for Ms. Wadsworth. Thank you, Mr. Hunter. Thank you both for being here. Could you please introduce yourself? Mr. Hunter, please do the same for the licensee for the record. You're welcome to make a statement to the board at this time. If you could just please keep that under 5 minutes, that'd be greatly appreciated. After any such statement, then we'll open up the forum to board members asking any questions they may have.
Absolutely. Good morning. I'm Jeff Hunter, counsel for Ms. Wadsworth, and Don Wadsworth is on the Zoom. Don, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Good morning. My name is Don Wadsworth.
And given that we've had two hearings on this issue, I think we're all talked out on the issue. So we're not going to make any further statement this time. We're obviously here to answer any questions that any of the board members may have. Thank you.
Appreciate that. And I just want to confirm, Ms. Wadsworth, you're not going to make a statement either. Your attorney is making that statement for you as well.
Yes.
Thank you. Board members, upon reviewing any of the materials, do you have additional questions for the licensee or her attorney? Okay. Hearing none, I'll just make some additional comments based on the CBA meeting, just to kind of provide a little bit more information. I think Dr. Davis Wilson did a very good job on the summary with regard to the issues that were weighed by the committee. And there were several things that were at play there, whether it was Ms. Wadsworth's feelings around the ethical practices at the agency that which she was working at, also the manner of which departure occurred, and also the ability of the agency to be able to provide coverage post her departure. Those were really the three key aspects that the committee dove into in their discussions with Mr. Hunter and Ms. Wadsworth on the call. And I believe that the committee's recommendation is solid. Any further discussion from board members? If not, I'll entertain a motion.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would just like to move that we go ahead and approve the non-disciplinary letter of concern with the CE order as stipulated, and that'll be all.
Second that.
Very good. We have a first from we have a motion from Dr. Davis Wilson. We have a second from Mr. Nguyen. Any further discussion? Mm-hmm. Hearing none, we'll call the question. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Nope, thank you. Any opposed? Any abstaining? All right, motion carries. Thank you very much. Thank you, Ms. Wadsworth, for being here. And also your council board staff will be in contact with any next steps.
Thank you much. Appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, we will now move on to complaint number 2323, Dan Halliberry. I'm lead for 11B, so I'll provide a case review summary to include the recommendation. So with regard to this case, the committee went through the complaint piece by piece. I think the highlights here for the full board that ultimately led to the recommendation for dismissal was a discussion with the licensee around some of the terminology that was being used as part of a training, and where some of the perhaps as the complainant actually outlines, had some misunderstandings with regard to some of the understanding with that terminology, terms such as response costs, such as prompting, such as physical intervention. Upon discussion with the licensee, the committee found that that those definitions that were provided were in line with the behavior analytic approach. In addition, though, we did point out that there, you know, with regards to response costs, that there is a mixed bag out there around research. Dr. Davis Wilson brought that up in the loosely in the conversation. That there is, in terms of reinforcement and then being able to take it away, that there are particular populations that serves well with. There are other populations that we serve that kind of behavior management system, whether it be in a classroom, whether that be in a center, whether that be at home, may be a little bit more difficult to actually gain and maintain appropriate behavior. The committee continued with that line of questioning. Also discussed, also had on the call the individual that was reported to be asked to do a burpee during a training. We got some information around what that exercise was all about. The licensee explained, and the RBT concluded that it was a discussion about ratio strain. It was a discussion about how tasks are extremely difficult and how maybe you can do one or two and then you have to stop. It may not be the best exercise, but definitely did not rise to any sort of statutory significance. With regard to some of the discussion around some hostilities and some aggressive language via text and via communications, we delve into that as well. Halliberry did recognize that as he could have done a better job of stepping away from the situation and not texting back immediately with regard to some of the claims that the complaint was making. He recognized that was on him and that he needed to be more professional in interactions around that. Again, nothing there that raised to a statutory limitation. Finally, I'll just conclude with the recommendation from the board, which was for this to be dismissed, recommendation from the committee that this complaint be dismissed by the full board. Any questions for me? All right. Mr. Halliberry, are you present? I believe you confirmed that you were going to be here today, and I think I saw you. Oh, there you are, sir. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you are welcome to make a statement to the board at this time. Please keep your statement under 5 minutes.
Hello, everyone. My name is Dan Halliberry. I'm willing to answer any questions anyone might have, but other than that, I don't have anything to add.
Very good. Thank you. Is the complainant, J.A., present? And if so, do you wish to make a brief statement to the board? I believe we have indication that she will not be present today. Thank you. Board members, any questions for Mr. Halliberry? All right. Hearing none. Appreciate that. All right, hearing none, go ahead and entertain a motion.
Move that we dismiss the complaint.
Second.
Dr. Stewart has moved for a dismissal and Mr. Nguyen has seconded. Any further discussion? All right, hearing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Oh, sorry, Dr. Catarita, was that an aye?
Aye, yes.
Aye.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Malott. Any opposed? Any abstaining? Motion carries. Thank you very much, Mr. Alberry. Appreciate you being here today. And I apologize if I did not say thank you to Ms. Wadsworth. I think I did, but appreciate her being here as well. All right, moving on. Dr. James Wilson, again, you are up for complaint number 2331, Ms. Jamie Jones. Dr. James Wilson, will you provide a summary of 11C and include the recommendation from the committee?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So Ms. Jones is before the board today. The board staff had received an anonymous complaint regarding third-hand information for a potential dual relationship between a registered behavior technician and her listed supervisor, Jamie Jones. The board staff did investigate the matter. They were able to obtain a little bit of additional information, but not anything substantial. They did provide that information as well as a letter to Ms. Jones. Ms. Jones immediately responded to the board staff. She also took immediate action to ensure that her connection between that RBT and the supervisor was removed from the board website. Ms. Jones did provide the committee a timeline of dates relating to the formation of the relationship post what she outlines as a post supervisory relationship, and that individual RBT was working. That individual RBT did seek other employment and that it was just an oversight on Ms. Jones' behalf for not having removed that connection in the online portal. Upon receiving the letter, she immediately removed that connection. She, before the committee, in the committee meeting, did humbly take accountability for the role that that may have taken in kind of the trickling effect of this information. She also had acknowledged to the committee that she has put steps in place to ensure that anytime there's a departure between a registered behavior technician and her role as a supervisor, that she will utilize kind of a checklist and a check management system to ensure that she makes those changes in the proper registries. The committee reviewed the information and found that the changes that Ms. Jones initiated, as well as the timeline she provided, led us to a recommendation of a dismissal, and that is what is before you today.
Thank you, Dr. Davis Wilson. Any questions for Dr. Davis Wilson? Ms. Jones, I see you are present as you were for the committee hearing. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you're welcome to make a statement to the board. Board at this time. Please keep your statements under 5 minutes.
Good morning, Jamie Jones. I don't really have an additional statement to add today, but I'm here to answer any questions that anybody may have.
Thank you for being here. Any additional questions for Ms. Jones? All right. Hearing none. Well, let's entertain a motion.
Move to dismiss.
All right.
Second.
I've got a dismissal coming from Dr. Stewart, the second from Dr. Catarino. Any further discussion? Nothing. I'll just add to the discussion that, you know, it was apparent through the CBA meeting notes that Ms. Jones' preparedness and then accountability was duly noted. Also, I noted that I was the curmudgeon of the group. While I recognize the need for anonymous complaints, this one, had there been contact between this individual and Ms. Jones around this issue, could have been dealt professionally, level to level, and not have taken, to the steps of having to to come before a committee and then a full board. And so for those on the call that are students or that are, you know, current BCBAs or psychologists or other professionals, you know, there is that ability inside of the ethics code to talk to someone. You know, there's nothing stopping you from having a conversation to see if you can get things going in the right direction and make an impact. And so I encourage individuals to take a look at that prior to moving forward to more serious steps.
Actually, I think it is a recommended procedure to approach the person first, not just as an alternative option. It is the recommended first line of action.
Absolutely. Yeah. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor of the dismissal?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstaining? Motion unanimously carries. Thank you, Ms. Jones, for being here today. Appreciate it. And board staff may be in touch. I forget if I think on the dismissal, they'll give you a few more documents for your records. Board staff, pleasure to go back. What's our pleasure? Go back to seven.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we can certainly do that. There are three agenda items, which are mine and one that is Dr. Davis Wilson. So maybe I can defer to her and ask her if she wants to go next, or if she would prefer I address some of mine.
Ms. Pacadon, if you would not mind, I'm about to have just a little bit of a glitch in my connectivity, but it will not interfere with my ability to listen. I just don't want it to interfere with my presentation.
Fair enough. Then we will make, based on our technological challenges, which we all love and adore, we will move on to Ms. Backen's items, which I believe begin on 8, and then we'll move to 9 and 10, correct? All right. Item number 8, discussion, consideration, possible action regarding psychological and behavior analytics services delivered through telehealth. Ms. Pacadon, will you please provide an update on this matter for the board?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'll try to tee up what I think will be potentially a robust conversation among the members of the board. This item was requested to be placed on a meeting agenda, and so I prepared some resources for that conversation. I think that the logical place to start when exploring the topic of telehealth, of course, is the statutes and rules. And so I provided the board with the language from the psychologist statutes and administrative rules that have addressed telehealth. And much of that language is historical language. It's been in place for a number of years. And then I've also supplied the language for the, it was a sweeping telehealth bill proposed in 2021 that established a series of new statutes. Some of these statutes, you'll find them starting on page 6 of your document. So the first citation, 36-3601. So these statutes are very broad. They apply to a series of licensed health professions. In this case, and in this board's case, this language introduced, I believe, for the first time, the ability for behavior analysts to deliver services via telehealth. But it's important to note that these statutes have the wide impact that they do, and they're not under the board's own title and chapter. So they begin with 3601, and in particular, I believe it is 3602 that provides the statutory authority for the actual delivery of services. There are some other statutes that address the medium through which services can be provided. And then 3606 establishes the telehealth registry that this board has discussed in several instances in the past. This telehealth registry was essentially activated by the board on October 1 of 2022. It's quite unpopular. We've only had 14 applicants in, 7 months apply for an authorization to practice via telehealth into Arizona. One other note, going back to the board's own language, which you will find the administrative rules on page 4 of your document. There's some content in the definitions, and then, of course, the actual language for practice. Dr. Meyer and I spent some time when the telehealth statutes were enacted in September of 2021. We looked at the board's administrative rules, and what we determined was that there wasn't any, this new statute language did not compel our board to make any revisions to our administrative rules. In other words, our rules were not contradictory to anything in the new statutes. And then finally, because as you would imagine, the board staff receives quite a few questions about, you know, telepractice, telehealth, am I authorized to do this? How do I do that? And so forth. We do have some content on our website that we offer to applicants potential applicants or other stakeholders. In doing so, we're very careful to provide some caveats in terms of, you know, we don't know if this is truly the most comprehensive set of statutes and rules that address practice. It's what we know to exist. This is a rapidly changing area of policy. There is certainly information that on the federal level that has implications or potential implications for telehealth practice. Reimbursement is a whole other type of set of questions and issues. And so we don't claim to be experts or to understand the universe of information on this very broad topic. So I don't know if the board needs any additional resources to have the conversation that you want to have, but this is what I'm providing for you just by way of a starting point. Do you have any questions for me?
I have one question just with regard to the current political landscape and with regard to whether or not these are, is the cat out of the bag? Are these here to stay, right? I mean, these were all added in response to the pandemic. Do we believe, and I have my own opinion on this, do we believe these are here to stay from your indications, from other stakeholders across the state that includes our legislators, that includes the governor's office? Do we believe that 3601, you know, all the way through through 6 are going to stay and not be struck out anytime in the near future?
Yes, Mr. Chair. What I can say, my insight isn't as deep or broad as perhaps it could be, but what I observed is truly the lack of legislation that was proposed in the session that will never end, the 2023 session. Mr. Nguyen knows what I'm talking about. I just found it very curious that there was a very obvious absence of bills that address this topic in any way, shape, or form. You don't see any really on my tracking report. I heard only minimal conversations about, and mostly in passing when I attended Health and Human Service committee meetings. I did hear one member articulate that, you know, maybe we've gone too far, at least she had felt that some conversations that she had had with her constituents reflected that, you know, constituents don't or patients don't always want their services delivered through telehealth, which, you know, I would think they would still be able to exercise, you know, a choice. But I don't, you know, to your point, the cat's out of the bag. Maybe I would say it this way. it's really difficult to put the toothpaste back in the tube. So I don't know if this will be revisited again in 2024, but you know, we've been living with this legislation, if you will, for almost 2 years. My colleagues, I don't hear a whole lot from them, except for, you know, they've affirmed what I mentioned earlier, which is the telehealth registry is not, there aren't a lot of people seeking authorization to practice in that way. Maybe the only other thought that I have, and, you know, Dr. Katarina or Dr. Malott can certainly chime in and augment what I remember hearing at ASPPB's meeting on Dr. Stewart as well, that there are some companies that are using telehealth platforms to recruit and hire psychologists and deliver services under questionable arrangements. So that's a whole a presentation in and of itself of the examples of how, you know, telehealth has really opened the door to, you know, potential substandard care, even fraud. So I think that this board may see some cases in the future where that is an element. There's a whole lot of private equity that's pouring into some of these, you know, companies to develop these platforms, to recruit psychologists or maybe people who aren't quite qualified to deliver psychological services, and, you know, matching them with clients. And there's really very little regulation or oversight of those practices. So it's something for us to be aware of and, you know, potentially anticipate.
I had one other follow-up question, and I see Dr. Davis-Wilson has got her hand raised. In terms of, you know, if tomorrow I decide I want to register, what is the, in terms of statutory or in terms of our own constraints, what's the timeline look like from the time I fill out the form online to the time I am essentially given the green light to engage in telehealth practices?
Mr. Chair, so we treat the telehealth registry as though applications as we do any other applications. And so when we promulgated the rule language after the enactment of these statutes, we did two things. We established the application fee and we also established timeframes for application processing. And we aligned those processing timeframes consistent with every other application type, rather than, you know, attempt to come up with, you know, a different set of timeframes. That's what sort of made sense at the time. So any application, whether it's a regular application, universal recognition, telehealth registry, they're all treated the same, you know, with a 30-day administrative timeframe, with a substantive review timeframe, with, you know, deficiency notices and fares and so forth. So we felt that consistency was the best practice to follow.
Very good. I appreciate that. All right, let's continue with the comments and the questioning. Dr. Davis-Wilson.
Yeah, my first comment is just going to be to kind of support perhaps what the ASPPB meeting was discussing with psychologists. I think we're seeing that in behavior analysis as well. And I also think we have, you know, kind of a subset of a population that we predominantly serve that isn't always responsive to telehealth delivery. And I share similar sentiments within the behavior analytic field as far as the continued training and support that's needed, that this isn't just a, well, it's convenient to provide telehealth, so now I'm going to. I think that it becomes a scope of practice conversation, even within behavior analysis. On that note, though, on a whole separate kind of piece, one of my concerns with the telehealth registry is around the language and how it then translates to behavior analysis. Or, you know, in the telehealth registry, it does require that you're licensed in another state, and it doesn't extend authority. So, for example, a physical therapist with a PTA working underneath them wouldn't have the ability to extend that supervisory authority. And in behavior analysis, we provide tiered services. And so we have the behavior analyst, but then we have the registered behavior technicians. And oftentimes those behavior technicians are boots to the ground providing services to the individual, with the supervisor kind of providing that oversight remotely. I am concerned that the language, well, it's clear for me, but I'm not sure that it's clear for the general behavior analytic community, that if you are overseeing a technician, that technician would be exempt under our statute, licensure statute, which is 32-2091.08, but wouldn't otherwise be exempt under the telehealth registry. And so I do have some concerns with what that would look like as far as individuals who may think, well, I'm, you know, licensed in Texas, I can go ahead and just go through this telehealth registry, and they find themselves potentially supervising registered behavior technicians. I think that could become problematic.
Yeah, Dr. Wilson, those are all good points. And I think also we've seen in the committee, to your point, the issue of individuals that are providing even supervision to people wanting to become BCBAs, right? And these individuals are not licensed in the state, and that supervision is not appropriate. And then that creates, you know, significant issues for the future workforce as they're working through their programs and their hours. So I completely agree with your sentiments there. Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'd like to reinforce what Ms. Packinen said when we attended the ASPPB meeting in Denver, along with Drs. Caterino and Malott and Medina, that this was a hot topic discussion about telehealth and what it can provide, and then the pitfalls that can come along the way. I think we've already seen an example of that here on our board with someone doing telehealth evaluations for a service animal industry, an emotional support animal industry. And I think it's going to become more and not less of an issue. Thank you.
Yes, Dr. Caterino.
I think, like, if you have an existing client that maybe is on a vacation or attends college or something for a few months, that's different than some of these companies that are just setting up to, you know, large businesses. But I know there's nothing, I don't know how they would establish, distinguish between that, you know, because of the continuity of care, you may want to continue with that client when they're temporarily somewhere else. But then, as opposed to these large companies that come in and just either behavior analysts or psychologists. We saw that with another, I thought Dr. Stewart was going to mention person that was licensed and then really not licensed in 5 or 6 states and providing services in all of them. You know, so I don't know what can be done about that, but I just want to raise that point. I think they're different issues.
Dr. Davey, this is Adi Dainar. Can I make a comment?
Of course. Thank you for jumping in, Mr. Dainar. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. So I just wanted to mention a few thoughts I had regarding telehealth, especially the statute set 36-3601 and in that sequence. So the way that I'm reading the statute, the statute defines healthcare provider as someone who is licensed in the state of Arizona and who wants to provide telehealth services to really anybody in Arizona or outside of Arizona. So because of the way healthcare provider is defined, it's not a pathway for someone who is licensed in another jurisdiction to simply register under the telehealth registry and then provide services in Arizona. But, you know, that maybe is an issue that we might need to confront at some point. And many of these sort of telehealth practices before the statute became effective were under many executive orders by our governor in Arizona, but also by almost every other governor in the United States. So anybody could practice anybody anywhere, really. And the sort of not sticking point, but the friction in that comes into play when when the board sort of looks at its role in protecting, especially, I mean, in Arizona, our role is to protect the public in Arizona. And our role isn't to protect, you know, say the public in Illinois, but the Illinois board would perceive an Arizona licensee who is registered in our telehealth registry providing services to someone in Illinois, and that board's role would be to protect their public against, you know, whatever practices they deem to be unprofessional. So that sort of interaction between which board has jurisdiction, I mean, we will have jurisdiction because, you know, this is an Arizona license that you're talking about, but the complainant or the patient is somewhere else. And those are the kinds of issues that we, I think, we'll have to confront eventually. And I just wanted to make a comment regarding that because, you know, it's coming down the pipeline at some point.
Thank you. Those are excellent comments for our consideration. Thank you, Mr. Denner. Yes, Dr. Milot.
Well, good. You sensed, I was trying to put my hand up. Like Mr. Dinah, I think this is a wait and see kind of proposition. You know, right now, we've had actually a couple of cases that have come through where the people were licensed, and we actually did do some sanctions because of whatever, but not so much because they were doing telehealth, but the actual violations of our statutes regarding treatment or whatever the violation might have been. So telehealth is here to stay. You know, these big companies are a little problematic, but till we actually have cases, it's hard to, just hard to anticipate. But I think we need to be prepared, you know. So,
yeah. But I think it's also going to be incumbent upon us to make sure that we become very familiar with these particular statutes and that we're aware of, like, some of the stipulations around that, right? I mean, there's several sections in there of, like, what a provider cannot do. You know, they cannot essentially come in and then set up practice. They cannot then, you know, come in and physically face-to-face practice. And, you know, so there are just those particular nuances that will come into play should and or if and when any particular complaint rises to us through the process. Dr. Davis-Wilson, thank you for putting up your hand.
Yeah, thank you. I go back to, and I agree, I think that it's probably just a sit and wait and see it kind of pan out. But I still am concerned about the potential confusion around the tiered service delivery model. And I know that when this first came out, we raised the concern around, does this open the door for the supervision issue that we were running into? And we had decided to put on the website that hours spent, if you're on the telehealth registry, then that does not give you kind of the authority to provide behavior analysis trainees supervision. I'm wondering if, and perhaps this is more of just a Jane Galvin question, do we see a need, or can we provide some additional information on the website related to the lack of applicability to the tiered service model for the behavior analyst? Or do we just wait until it's before us and see it at that time?
I think from a general statement about potential drawbacks or activities that are precluded, could be developed or written and placed on the website. You know, obviously you're not addressing any particular case before you, but some advisory statement would be acceptable, or statements of kind of cautionary statements.
Thank you. And I say that I think that one, that would be helpful, seeing just the, in the committee meetings, we've seen a very consistent kind of disconnect between that supervisory role between a behavior analyst and a behavior technician already. And so I do think that would help kind of head off some of those potential issues. But I also think that because we already made kind of the advisory statement on the other supervision issue, I worry that by saying nothing, they may just think, oh, the only thing precluded is actual supervision towards licensure, and not recognize that the RBTs practicing face-to-face in the state of Arizona, or practicing at all, are not covered under the telehealth registry. So I would like, you know, at a minimum, to maybe get something up to help support the complexity of that.
Dr. David, can I say something on that point? Thank you. So I think, I mean, there are other licensing boards in Arizona and elsewhere who are, I think, making a distinction between direct supervision and indirect supervision. And I mean, in our statutes, you know, our psychology statutes just say supervision. It doesn't distinguish between direct and indirect. And perhaps it's a little bit more complicated in this profession, but in, you know, let's say some physician related medical professions where, you know, you have to perform, you know, services on a patient physically. They already had some rule language and some statutory language making a distinction between direct supervision and indirect supervision. And when the all of the telehealth executive orders started coming down, the boards interpreted their direct supervision rules or statutes to require, you know, in-person supervision and not just indirect supervision. So maybe, I mean, I'm understanding the concern that Dr. Davis Wilson voiced, and our rules or statutes don't really distinguish between direct or indirect, but maybe that's one way to think about how to, you know, resolve the concern that Dr. Davis Wilson had.
Thank you for that, Mr. Janner. Before I go, Ms. Becken, before I go to Dr. Davis Wilson, did you want to interject on Mr. Danner's comment?
No, I think that it's a very good point between the direct and the indirect. I do think there's just the complexity around the delivery of service from a non-credentialed or non-licensed individual. Because that's, at least for the RBT level, that's where kind of that concern is. But I think that could help delineate what we're kind of talking about, because I do think that we do see some of kind of that indirect supervision type role, where there's folks that are also operating in person. But I would just, again, you know, just want to make sure it's clear that individual RBT who would be otherwise exempt under 32-209.1.08, which says, you know, they can practice under the extended authority of a licensed behavior analyst. I would just want, you know, and I don't think we have anybody from the professional association on today, but I would just, you know, want to make sure that that's clear there. But I do think that looking at some of those definitions around indirect and direct could be helpful and in kind of teasing some of that out. And I think that the education back to the behavior analyst as far as, again, those that line of staff is practicing under the extended authority of the license, not any other capacity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ms. Backen has been waiting patiently to chime in. The one other thing that I think I would just add to this conversation is, you know, as we look at some of the statute essentially exemptions, right, as they stand, you know, you have some exemptions within our current rules and statutes that speak to, you know, 20 days of practice in the state, you know, assuming 8 hours a day, you know, 160 hours that someone could actually be practicing without a license or without this registration piece. And so maybe even kind of thinking about how those kinds of exemptions, I guess I'm almost picturing like a matrix, if you will, of, you know, here are the different paths into working in our state, and here are the ways those work, and the kind of the rules or the guidelines that, you know, are critical inside of each of those paths. And maybe that's something that we work to put together as almost a matrix around that to better delineate, you know, what is acceptable and what is not, given now that we have, you know, outside of the exemptions, we have, you know, universal recognition. We have this, we have normal ways to come through the door, right? We are all of a sudden from one paper application, not that many years ago, we have now multiple pathways, no wrong doors into practicing in the state of Arizona. So such a guideline may be, or such a tool may be helpful. Ms. Packenham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I think some of the comments that you just made were extreme. I'm glad they preceded what I was going to offer. So I definitely I'm hearing interest in let's augment our content that we present to stakeholders on this topic. And I really want to tackle this enthusiastically. I would love specifically Dr. Davis Wilson's help just to make sure that the complexity of the behavior analytic issues are effectively addressed in anything that we do develop. So I really do want to move forward with what it is that I think you're going to direct me to do. That being said, I feel that, you know, the conduit through which we often choose to provide information, or I should say, clarification on interpretation of statutes and rules, is a substantive policy statement. I don't think substantive policy statements are effective, are all that effective in, I don't think people read them, quite frankly. So I hope that we can achieve what we want to achieve in such a way that it's present, it's accessible, it's digestible. I love the idea about a matrix. So, you know, unless Ms. Galvin feels strongly otherwise, I think I want to first attempt to make this information very, very present, very obvious on our website. And then, I mean, if we have to go the substantive policy statement route, you know, so be it. One other comment, and this is more specific to something that I think we're going to continue to see. We did have an applicant for the registry very recently who is a non-licensed BCBA. He's in Colorado, state that doesn't require licensure. And it seems that he has never applied for and been granted a license to practice in any other jurisdiction. And so the comments that we have, that he's made just in our email exchange about his ineligibility for the registry suggests to me the kinds of things that Dr. Davis Wilson is cautioning about, that the registry may be perceived as, you know, this is how we are able to expand our services and into Arizona, and only through telehealth, exclusively through telehealth. And in doing so, the vision may be to do so in a way that's much broader than the law actually allows. So that's just something that is in the back of my mind with respect to this particular situation.
Okay, so I think I hear, Ms. Packanen, maybe you'll do a better job of summarizing what you think we need to what you're hearing in terms of our desires. But I think that we haven't heard from all board members, but definitely some clarity is required, whether that's a internal document that we're working on first that maybe turns into some sort of kind of e-communication out to our licensees or to the or out in general on our website. We probably need to get some of that built out correct before we would want to go out and publish it. So maybe it is kind of that that matrix, that clarification, that kind of document that may delineate the past, the rules and the regulations that are attached to those. So maybe it's beginning there and then bringing that down to something that is digestible by our licensees. But I'll let Ms. Packanen, I'll let you kind of help steer this conversation since it'll be you and your staff that'll be, along with many of the other things we do, kind of tasked with getting this put together.
I think, Mr. Chair, you said that perfectly well. So I think I'm clear on what my assignment is going to be. I did want to also make sure that there was an opportunity to acknowledge SciPact, because I that hasn't been, really part of this conversation yet. I do try to keep the board informed. We always get the credit for being the first state to enact the legislation, and then we sort of had to wait for six other states to do so before the compact then was enacted, which was the summer of 2020. So the expansion of SciPact into 37 jurisdictions now, or by late summer, 37 jurisdictions, I think it is. Even some jurisdictions that, originally had, they were dubious about this initiative, and now they're fully on board. So that is, the type of practice authorization where on a national, sort of public policy focused level, the Council of State Governments, the National Conference of State Legislatures, those groups are touting interstate compacts as the best crafted solution to facilitate delivery of services, including services by telehealth. So, of course, it's no accident, too, that we present SciPact, pretty prominently on our website as perhaps an option for those individuals, psychologists outside of our state, to seek authorization to practice into Arizona. And there's two types of authorizations with SciPact. There is the telehealth authorization, and then there is one that enables the psychologist to be present in Arizona for 30 days, also to deliver services. There is no such interstate compact yet for behavior analysts, but at least I think it was you, Dr. Davey, that said that those conversations are at least starting to happen.
Okay, so I think Ms. Galvin, if you want to chime in, do we need just a consensus on this action? I don't think we need a motion or anything, correct?
No, I believe that you've given Ms. Packanen enough direction for her to proceed, and then obviously it'll be presented back to the board in the future.
Very good. Any other further discussion around this matter before we move on? Thank you, board members, again, for coming prepared and for adding to this discussion. I think that this is extremely helpful as we continue to navigate kind of the evolution of our practices and our fields. All right, let's move on then to, I believe it's number 9, correct? Or did I skip one? 7, 8, maybe. 8, no, we're on 9. Very good. Discussion consideration of possible action relating to the consideration of possible merit-based incentive pay for board staff. agenda item number 9. Ms. Pakanan, will you please provide an update on this matter for the board? Prior to you doing that, Ms. Galvin, just a question with regard to the fact that this pertains to staff, not necessarily Ms. Pakanan, as she is the executive director, but is this something we would do in executive session?
You are able to do that in executive session. However, I do not see the executive session listed on the agenda.
But I'm saying, could we go into, oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, well then I guess we can have this in public. And if anyone or myself or Ms. Galvin, you feel like we're going into an area where we need to put this into a discussion that's outside of the public forum, then please chime in.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we can keep this all, open and public session oriented. So this is a request by me and Ms. Michelson to authorize the two of us to essentially avail our agency of what is a permission granted in the personnel rules for the state of Arizona. We do have certain options where we can issue or award merit-based incentive pay to staff. So there's parameters, of course, that establish, you know, what we're permitted to do and you know, boundaries that we must stay within. But I've outlined those in the memorandum. Typically, what we have done for now a series of years, at least as long as that I've been here, and I think even my predecessors did as well, that we have elected to issue what are called thought incentives to staff. So these are one-time lump sum financial awards, you know, assuming the employees meet whatever criteria that we have established. We do have, a ceiling in terms of the funds that are available to issue these, and it's about $6,200 that we, based on our appropriation, that we are allowed to use. So this time of this point of the fiscal year, it's a little too soon for us to have absolute clarity in terms of what will be, you know, our final expenses. And I always report in my executive director's report what the spending gap is. So I monitor that very closely. And so, you know, I'm aware of, you know, the more that time marches on, what we will not spend, what we will underspend relative to our appropriations. So in the past, I have asked the board for the authorization to, you know, within the parameters, within the funds available, to make decisions relative to awarding these incentives to staff. I am not eligible as the agency director, but the other four members of the staff are eligible. And we would, Ms. Michelson and I, we would tie that the incentive amounts or the decision to award incentives, if you will, to the performance appraisal results. As I had mentioned, I know in my executive director's reports earlier this year, performance appraisals were conducted for employees for 2022. And so that would highly inform us relative to whether and how much to award a spot incentive. I am not certain that the total incentives would necessarily reach, you know, that ceiling that we are granted, but this is something that I've asked for typically this time of year, and the board has granted the authority to do so. And I document that, of course, when I'm informing the payroll department about these incentives. I'm happy to answer any questions or clarify anything that I just explained.
No, and reading through the documentation, I mean, I think that you hit on the key points, right? The eligibility piece of the employee must meet, you know, kind of the overall meets expectations, you know, that has to be essentially throughout their entire evaluation. There's a couple other, you know, eligibility rules in there, the documentations that you put through. You know, I believe that this is a no-brainer with regard to looking at our staff and their abilities to keep us organized, their professionalism, and and what I'm assuming will be extremely high ratings on most of their most of the areas that they will be evaluated on. I, for one, think that these are dollars that are allocated to us as an agency. These spot dollars are set there to be able to provide merit-based incentives and to be able to provide incentives to staff that are going above and beyond. And I would like to see us, make a motion to authorize you to be able to award that total up to $6,288 if it so rises to that number, and use those dollars that we have in our fund to reinforce, reward, and to thank our staff for their hard work and their due diligence in keeping this board moving and keeping the state of Arizona's citizens that access our services or access our professional practices safe. Dr. Davis-Wilson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with all of the sentiments that you have said. I also just want to note again for the record that, especially on the behavior analyst side, we have seen a just large amount of growth, growth in applications, growth in complaint reviews, growth in just policy circumstances and conversation. And that has come without a ton of additional administrative support as far as bodies and extra hands and extra time goes. And so I think this is a very important mission, if you will, to do this evaluation and consider the merit pay, because these folks are working very hard. We're getting emails on weekends. We're getting emails on evenings. We're getting emails during times that many folks wouldn't even be willing to work, and they continue to go above and beyond to make sure that their job is done well. And then in return, that makes our job easier. So I just wanted to make sure that was acknowledged and talked.
Dr. David, can I say something?
Yeah, Mr. Diner, we're going to go to you, and then we'll jump back up to the line.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. I just wanted to wholeheartedly agree with everything that was said thus far. I just wanted to offer sort of a friendly suggestion to the proposal that Dr. Davey, you proposed. I think if we can sort of max out the allowable total amount of spot incentives, then I would be in favor of that. So I don't want to say, well, you know, just the amount that is, $6,000-something. If we can say $6,000-something as stated in our materials, or, whatever the maximum amount after running the numbers comes out to be, whichever amount is higher, that should be the total spot incentive, because that, I think, gives our executive director the authorization from the board to go up to the maximum possible amount. Absolutely. In spot incentive. And I wanted to also say, you know, our staff works extremely hard, and, you know, everybody goes above and beyond. Spot incentives, for whatever it's worth, are sort of backwards looking in the sense that, you know, we are looking at the past performance and, choosing to recognize the contribution of our staff to the functioning of the board and for preparing us as board members for these meetings. But there's also sort of this concept in the business world where any sort of compensation increases also need to be forward-looking, in the sense that, you know, we are recognizing past performance and also sort of betting on the same kind of continued effort in the future and giving some sort of salary increases. That's not just a backwards-looking spot incentive. It's more of sort of like investment in our staff looking forward. And if there is any mechanism, I know there's, you know, tons of red tape with the Department of Administration and whatnot with salary increases and cost of living increases, but to the extent that we can provide that to our board staff, I would be in favor of that as well.
Yep, I would absolutely accept your amendment that we go up to the, you know, that the agency, or that Ms. Packenham and our agency be authorized to assign or to use the merit, you know, to the maximum extent available in terms of funds. I completely agree. Don't want to put a number on it because maybe that, you know, maybe that number ends up being double, or maybe it ends up being a few thousand dollars more. So would completely agree with that and all your other sentiments there. Thank you, Mr. Dinard. Ms. Pacanon, do I really have to call on you, or can I call on other board members first?
I'll wait.
Fair enough. Because I think, you know, I think that we'll get there. We'll get to you, I promise. Dr. Stewart.
Thank you. I want to jump in on the accolades. I don't know if Ms. Pacanon and Ms. Michelson are Energizer bunnies, lion timers, or cat herders, but I think they qualify for all of the above. I think the agency has run very well. And that, of course, cannot be done without support staff, the investigators that join us in every committee meeting. And as you've already said, Mr. Chair, they come prepared and keep us in line. And I'm just so appreciative. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Katerina.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I wanted to know two things. Would this be maybe a possibility for every year, or is this a one-time deal?
This is something that has occurred multiple times since I've been on the board. Is it yearly, Ms. Pacanon?
Mr. Chair, that's a great question. So we do budget anticipating some costs may or may not be incurred, right? Physical security at a board meeting, we may or may not need, to spend those dollars. Expert reviewers, we may have, cases in a year where we tap into those experts and incur those costs less frequently that we had projected. So it's typically those dollars that can be repurposed. And this is an opportunity for me to provide some clarification. We are a lump sum appropriation agency. So the legislature tells us you have this much money to spend and not a penny more for this fiscal year. Because it's lump sum and it doesn't have, granted, we do have some agreements that we have to honor, our rent and some other contracts. But if we wanted to spend all the dollars on boxes of paper, we have the latitude to do that. So there isn't any problems we're not complying or failing to comply if we, decide these dollars weren't spent, they're now available for this purpose. And that's a pretty typical situation. It may be that in a future fiscal year, everything that we brainstormed that we might possibly have to spend dollars on, we have to. And so there may be a year where, I have to, I have to have the conversation with the board and staff that I'm sorry, we just can't do spot incentives or that maybe the spot incentives are quite low.
Okay. And I know we probably have a little more if they do allow us to carry the budget from year to year, because we haven't gone in person to the meetings until this year at the ASPA, ASPPB, I mean.
Right. Once upon a time, in the glory days, I'll call them, we did have a biennial budget appropriation. I guess there were some drawbacks to that too, but it gave agencies a little bit more latitude that if you had lower expenses in one year, in the second of the biennial period, the second year, then equipment could be replaced and salaries could be increased and those kinds of things. But in the interim between my time at PT board and this board, all agencies are now on an annual budget cycle. So we don't have that, flexibility any longer.
The bigger question I have is you quickly said, and of course I don't qualify for this. Is there any other way to reward you to ask maybe for salary increase? It just doesn't seem fair that you wouldn't get anything.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Dr. Katerino. But as the agency director, I do get much of the fame and the glory. So there is that.
but it'd be nice also to have some financial.
I appreciate that. I have not, I think this ties back to something Mr. Dinar was mentioning. Someday I want to have lunch with him. So he describes to me what the business world is truly like. I'm not familiar with it because I've only ever worked in nonprofits and governments. So it sounds intriguing to me. But I think that we do want to make a pivot in some fashion to looking at some more proactive strategies. I mean, you know, salary increases, they are not only a tool to reward, but they're a tool to retain, right?
Yes.
And so there are, I think, some agencies, the larger agencies, who have been able to very cleverly and very strategically address this, you know, through some things like, you know, appropriation, requests for appropriation increases. And there's some research that needs to be involved too. You know, we need to do some comparisons, you know, a market research, if you will. Are our licensing staff paid, you know, are their pay rates consistent with our peer organizations, you know, our deputy director, ED, you know, all those kinds of things. We need to take a comprehensive look at that and provide the data to support any sort of request for an increase in our appropriation for salary increases. I did want to say that last year, the Arizona State Legislature across the board granted a 10% increase for all state employees. Some specific position classifications were granted even higher than 10% because of recruitment and retention challenges. So that 10% accomplished a whole lot. It was 21 years since the legislature had done that, 21 years. So we were hoping, of course, that there would be, you know, maybe even a small adjustment in this year's budget. There was some proposal to do that, and then it was modified to, again, be very targeted to only specific positions. So we don't receive an across-the-board salary increase. So what I'm hearing you say will, of course, compel me to do what I know I need to do to start at least having this conversation with the governor's office of strategic planning and budget, and, you know, see where this takes us into. This will be at 2025 at the earliest sort of achievement, if we get there at all. But I'm prepared to put in the work, and I appreciate that, you know, the board seems to be nudging me in that direction.
And if we need to do something, to write letters or to do anything of support, I think most of us, if not all, would be in agreement. So,
very good. Dr. Mulott.
Oh, I just want to add my accolades as well. I really appreciate everything the staff does. It makes our lives easier. And one of the things, just to answer Dr. Caterino's comments, was when we do annual evaluations, at least for the executive director, that's one time when we do consider a recommendation for pay increases and do comp ratios as well. So that is our opportunity. And we do that, I think. I'm not sure when we did the last one, but I know that happened. So
thank you.
All right. Any additional comments? If not, I can reform this, and I can put this back as a motion that we, you know, I'll move that we. Oh, Dr. Mulott, did you still have a question?
Oh no, no, it's the old hand.
Old is your old hand.
Getting older by the minute.
So I would like to go ahead and make the motion that we allow Ms. Pakkinen to move forward with as part of the evaluation with our staff to include the spot dollars, and that as an agency in total, or as an agency as a whole, that we look at maximizing any of the dollars that are available to us as part of that process.
Second.
Everybody seconds. Any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstaining? Motion unanimously carries. Thank you very much. Ms. Pakkinen, you know, out of kind of following that line of discussion for you and Ms. Michelson, what is the review period for the different levels of our staff? Like, when is your, like, remind the groups of when that occurs?
Mr. Chair, so we follow the calendar year cycle. So we recently, we were one of the early agencies to transition from a system that the state of Arizona is gradually rolling out and replacing for all agencies. So there was a performance appraisal, a defined process, and you know, you worked within that process. Jennifer and I recognize that the new process, the new model that that agencies are shifting toward, we saw its benefits. And so we wanted to be one of the early adopters. And so that's the one that we applied for 2022. So, and I think universally, we were all pleased. It does have a component of, you know, self-reflection and goal setting, objective setting, in addition to the actual feedback piece. And the scoring mechanism, Ms. Michelson and I found it to be a lot more informative than the old system. So we intend to maintain this cycle. There were a few years where performance appraisals didn't happen. And so, you know, we are dedicated to staying, you know, on this cycle and having the appraisals done. It was March before we got them done for 2022. But, you know, we'll get more practice and we'll get better at this. That being said, I always feel that continual in the moment feedback for staff is equally as valuable. So that's something that I try to commit to supply to everyone, so that it isn't just sort of once a year where we sit down and we talk about, you know, their strengths and their performance and their behaviors and, you know, those kinds of things.
Marvelous. Thank you for that. Okay. I think that moves us on to number 10. And then shortly after that, we will go back to Dr. Davis-Wilson. So number 10, discussion, consideration, possible action regarding proposed legislation, including but not limited to a bunch of House bills and a bunch of Senate bills. Agenda item number 10, Ms. Pakkinen, will you please provide an update on this matter for the board?
Yes, Mr. Chair. And even though I mentioned a short time ago that this legislative session is it's enduring for a multitude of reasons, we'll just say there are by and large the work on the bills that, you know, we had been tracking, that's done, that's over. There's always, you know, as long as the legislature's in session, there's always a possibility that something, you know, may be proposed that, you know, we didn't see coming and has implications for our agency or for regulation in general. So I will continue to be vigilant as far as that's concerned. But what typically happens is, you know, I'm tracking 20, 30 or more bills, and very few of them actually limp across the finish line. And so the report reflects just that. So I only really want to talk about, there's probably just two of them, but I will mention Senate Bill 1270. So that was the one that speaks to reasonably ensuring that meeting rooms for public meetings have capacity. This bill got amended several times and watered down, if you will, and so I'm not even sure it still pertains, you know, to this type of agency. But you know, I don't think this is something that we need to be directed to do. We will always try to accommodate you know, the public when we go back to in-person meetings, you know, and provide for adequate seating and so forth for anyone who wants to attend our public meetings. And then, you know, once the technology is, you know, fully in place and we feel that we can competently operate it, you know, I think continuing to allow and facilitate, you know, virtual attendance at our meetings, I don't see that ever, you know, going away. Senate Bill 1333, I've spoken to that one before, which is going to require us to report is it both revocations, just license revocations to the Department of Health Services into presumably, you know, a repository database that they will have to build and maintain. You know, this is something that, as I've said, we don't do all that frequently, but it's just something that Ms. Michelson and I have to remember to do, you know, once that legislation is in effect. And then finally, the only other bill to mention is the General Appropriations Act. So that funds our agency at the same baseline level as last year, or sorry, the current fiscal year, same amount of dollars. We have to make those stretch across all the things that, you know, we are mandated to do and, you know, what's necessary to protect the public. We did get a little bit of a bonus surprise in the Appropriations Act 2, which is $18,000 to continue implementing the Thentia system, because we were first and we're so far along in that process that I see that $18,000 as a bit of a gift, in that we can use it to make enhancements to the system, to make it better, to make it more efficient, to make it more user-friendly, not only for staff, but also for the other customers who use it. So I was pretty thrilled to see that we have that bonus, if you will, for technology. So I will very soon be sitting down and making some budget projections with Ms. Michelson. I really include her in that process. She's got some great insights, and I want her to, you know, become very proficient with this process as well. So because the legislature has not voted to sine die to conclude the session, this means that with the exception of the Appropriations Act, any enacted legislation, anything that Governor Hobbs signed, it will not go into effect because unless it has an emergency clause or otherwise provides, legislation becomes goes into effect 90 days after the close of the session. So a lot of what we know to be changing will just be at some unclear, it won't come into effect until some unclear date out into the future. So any questions about anything in this report or anything that I have explained?
I believe so. Anything from... It looks as if you've, you know, essentially answered all of our questions, Ms. Packenham. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Then let's go ahead and... I think that brings us back to you, Dr. Davis Wilson. I think we'll now roll over to item number 7. So item number 7, discussion, consideration, possible action concerning board certified behavior analysts, trainees, compensation of supervisors. This item is on the agenda by request from one of the board members, and Dr. Davis Wilson has agreed to provide an overview and explanation with respect to this topic for the board. Grab some popcorn, everyone, and let's enjoy the show. Does this come with slides, Dr. Davis Wilson?
No.
Prezi?
I wasn't that prepared.
All right. I'm prepared to learn from you. I'm ready for this to rock and roll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, this is a complex topic, and I think the easiest way to simplify it is that we're still a field in our infancy. The other thing I think that is unique about behavior analysis is that the nature as to how people grow as a professional is quite wide. We don't have well-defined like scopes of practice as far as what internships may look like. Oftentimes you'll see the majority of individuals going through some sort of autism or ASD-based program to accrue their hours. However, that is a newer, it's the largest way to access supervision hours, but it is one of the newer ways to access supervision hours. Historically, because behavior analysis was not funded, in order for individuals to have access to settings, they were oftentimes doing it within the confines of their other employment or certifications. So Early on, what we saw was a lot of school teachers who wanted to expand their knowledge. And in order for them to do so, they had to go through the coursework, and then they had to retain their own supervisors because the districts and or their employers were not in any position to hire or maintain behavior analysts for that purpose. And so while it seems like now that has shifted quite a bit, it hasn't shifted entirely in that we still have a vast number of populations that are being served that aren't necessarily the access at the employment level isn't there. And because it's a little bit different in independent practice, there's most definitely behavior analysts that do independent practice. Oftentimes they're working for larger organizations and or in other entities like the hospital systems or the education systems. So we have, as a field, have had some creative avenues, if you will, for accessing those supervised hours in light of the fact that most kind of employers aren't seeing a fiscal benefit of you know, contributing to that type of professional development to the individual professionals. And so what it has created is that in many settings, an individual that is not working under one of those kind of big box organizations is having to outwardly seek supervision independent of their employment. And so because of that, the access to revenue for the supervisors is truly only falling upon the individual supervisee as kind of a paid practicum. Now, we do have programs in which, and there's several models, and some models are more popular than others, but I think, there's just growing pains right now. But we do have programs in which some of the college coursework includes in the tuition a cost for practicum supervision. In those cases or those circumstances, the supervisors are oftentimes compensated by the university and not directly by the individual. Those are, they're available, but not as popular. And then again, what we see is folks that are interested in a scope of practice outside of autism oftentimes don't have access to supervisors without independently hiring them. And we see that in areas like criminal justice, in the juvenile system of care, foster care placements, because again, there just isn't funding that is wide and open. Now in Arizona, we have been able to pass quite a bit of policy initiatives around funding of behavior analysis outside of just the ASD population. And so I do foresee in the future a shift, but I still think as it stands right now, the ability for a supervisor to access any type of revenue outside of kind of, again, that big box employment exclusion is very challenging. Now, we do have a lot of individuals that are employed by large, like autism organizations. In those settings, it is very rare for supervision to be outwardly charged to the supervisor or to the supervisee. In other words, if they're working and that's a component of their job description, then their employers are paying the supervisors for that time. There isn't an additional there isn't an additional separation of the supervisors are getting paid by the supervisee and also getting paid by the organization. Now, in some of those cases, those organizations do have safeguards that require repayment of services. So they'll say, hey, you know, we think that your supervision experience is worth, you know, $2,500. If you stay with us for a year, you know, we'll cover that. If you leave, we're going to recoup the cost of that supervision. And so there is a little bit of those models. But for the most part, I would cop up the issue to being the complexity of the newness of the field And I would confirm that, again, in those, in the more typical settings, individuals are likely not paying directly for supervision. But there's those outliers that I just, despite my attempts to fathom a way to get around that, I just can't identify a means to do so. So it is a bit complex, and I do recognize, and I think we've seen even at the committee sometimes what the kind of muddiness of having an individual paying a supervisor for those services can lead to. But I just think that until we have very consistent revenue streams as a profession, it's going to be very difficult to expand the scope of those supervisees if they're not able to or willing to kind of invest in that independent work study, if you will, because oftentimes their employers are not supporting it. So that's kind of my summary. I know it's kind of convoluted, but happy to take questions on the matter as well.
Yes, Dr. Katerina.
Yes, I'm the one that brought this up because I was teaching a BCBA course maybe 10 years ago, and the students complained to me that they had to pay a lot of money to their supervisors, and it was very, you know, expensive to them. And I can see if they're doing it in their employment, that's one thing. And then I compared it to the – I was surprised because I knew a psychologist that was had some kind of discipline because he charged his intern money for overhead, like a certain 10% or something. I don't know exactly, but for, you know, electricity, secretarial service. And he had a disciplinary action for that. So I thought that it would be more parallel to that. So I did talk to the board many years ago, and they said, well, there's hardly – the reason they gave me is that there's very few supervisors. And so that's why we have to allow them to pay the supervisors. So as I've been on the board, I see the number of behavior analysts has really rocketed. So I would think that, you know, they would be able to, because there's more behavior analysts, I think, number-wise, maybe than even psychologists. So, no? What's the number?
No, it's more like 700 to 4,000 or so. I forget the number.
Exactly. Oh, okay. Then I'm totally wrong. But I thought there are a lot more than it was, you know, before. So I thought that maybe there should be similar guidelines, because the reason they had advanced for the psychologist I knew was that it was a dual relationship, that you could not be fair in evaluating your intern if you knew that if you terminated them, you would lose an income source, you know, or there was a, with that financial component, it could jeopardize a fair evaluation. So, and I think even when I started, you know, my number is 645, we never paid the supervisors. So even with a number that low. So anyway, I just thought that's why I'm going back to the student that was tearful with me, and I never forgot it. And I thought I'm going to bring this up someday. So,
no, I greatly appreciate your comments, and I'm glad we finally got to have some of this discussion. So I was actually just going to looking on my wall, like, you know, in terms of behavior analysts across the country, I think like I'm in like the 1400s for the nation. Like I was like one of the, you know, first 1500, you know, and now we're like in the 50, 60,000 across the US. You know, and my experience was that my supervision was attached to being a part of a clinic that was part of a university as part of my coursework that I went through to be able to receive that. So I, you know, I had a little different path towards how supervision was gained back in the early 2000s. And at that particular point, you know, that was one of the very few paths in there. There may be some people out there at that point that were providing some supervision, maybe in Florida, to be able to move people around. But I think Dr. Davis Wilson did a good job of kind of making some points. You know, there's different paths to be able to select from. So an individual does not only have the option to select a supervisor that they would pay out of pocket for. There are any number of jobs at any particular point here in the state of Arizona or across the country where you could go be an RBT or behavior tech, work for that company and work through their process of a clinician in training, accumulate your hours, all while getting paid and not be coming out of pocket. So those paths are pretty substantial now across the United States. Those have not always been there, but they are there. You also have individuals that maybe that's not for them, right? They're a slow little practitioner. They are interested in, they are maybe, just interested in this field. They've taken the coursework and maybe they don't want to work for a large organization for whatever reason they have. And so that provides them an option of going out and finding someone. There's many, you do a quick Google search of BCBA supervision. There's 100 companies out there that for $75 an hour will supervise you. And that's kind of the market at this particular point as individuals identify behavior analysis as an up and coming field. I believe it's like one of the top 100, jobs you can get these days. I would caution you that it is not an easy job and that it is very difficult as you kind of work through your program and then end up with the responsibility of those in your care. The other piece I would point out is also some specialization. I think Dr. Davis Wilson did a good job of hitting on that. Autism has, right or wrong, sucked the air out of the room in terms of what training looks like today. So, 90, I forget what the number is, but it's extremely high. I won't pretend to know it, but it is the overwhelming majority of BCBAs in the country work in autism. So if your interest is in severe complex behavior like myself or other developmental disabilities, or as Dr. Davis Wilson hit on, JJ, juvenile justice, or even environmental sustainability or gerontology, you're not going to want to go and work for one of those agencies. You're actually going to seek out an SME to be able to provide that supervision and to be able to move you along. And maybe that individual doesn't work for a large organization, is a solo practitioner, or works at a hospital and is doing this on the side, or is involved in some other agency. And so it just provides some other paths for individuals to accomplish those hours.
If we look at the psych consortium, they have many different specialties you can apply for postdoc, and they used to have it for internship, but none of those psychologists were paid.
Yeah. And so I would just say again, I think infancy is a good point there, right? So in autism, maybe that's the case. You would not necessarily need to pay to be able to do that. But if I wanted to go find someone that could supervise me for, a bulk of my practicum outside of my normal behavior analytic work and wanted to specialize in one of those areas, like environmental sustainability, I probably could pick from 15 to 20 people across the country. So it's a much smaller subset that have that. Even as you look at Dr. Davis and I, who are involved in public policy, which is not a specialty of this, but there are very few behavior analysts across the country that can speak to that out of the 50,000 people that are licensed or so. And so you still have some of those growing pains for us. I do want to make one more point with regard to the dual relationship, because I do think that that's a conversation worth extending. Individuals that engage in essentially seeking out a supervisor and deciding to pay for them independently or to be able to pay for their supervision. But there are guidelines provided by both the BACB around supervision contracts that speak to both parties' responsibilities that are executed with regard to their respective roles that outline costs. And then ultimately that point back to our ethics code as it relates to, I think we moved away from the term dual relationships, and now we use the term multiple relationships. Under BACB documentation, that's under 1.11. And it talks about the fact that because of those relationships, you know, there could be that conflict of interest, and that might be a harm to one party or another. And it outlines, you know, much like our own codes, it outlines what to do in those cases, how to be in front of those, how to be professional around those, how to continually monitor those and make sure that you're not running into a situation that may run afoul of our code, and ask that that information be documented as such, maybe potentially a contract. You're running notes that are required for you as a supervisor. You have certain responsibilities as a supervisor, particularly now where you go through 8 hours worth of training. You now have to, if you're a new BCBA, you have to be supervised post-certification for another year on top of the training to become a supervisor. Yeah. And all of those kinds of ethics are pulled through there because we realize that we are in many ways an apprentice program where we are training the next one, just like psychologists. And so I do want to give you a little sense of a security around the evolution of the ethics code from probably even, you know, 5 years ago to 10 years ago to 20 years ago for me. It has grown in its breadth as well as its clarity with regard to many things that behavior analysts or supervisees could run into.
Well, my thinking is, you know, originally the way it was presented to me is as there become more, this could change. And I just feel now it's getting really ingrained in the profession that there's no talk about maybe when there are 4,000, you know, BCBAs that we don't need to pay the supervisors. I think what I'm going to predict maybe is it's become such a part of it. Then you mentioned to me that there are supervisory companies that I think it may never change, even when it has a lot more, many more behavior analyst supervisors. And I'm thinking that we, you know, we're on the same board here and we have different rules in that way. So.
There are definitely different rules on both sides of the of this profession. I don't know that, I would say that you're correct. I don't know that the ability to be able to access specialty supervision by paying will ever go away just because of sheer market drivers in the system, right? I don't think that will go away, but I think to Dr. Davis's point around larger agencies that are now across the country that are the primary purveyors of autism services, which is the primary employment section for BCBAs, they are providing that without charge. They gain monetary value in other ways by cultivating that individual, training that individual, having them act as an RBT.
And the services, I mean, like for psychologists, they're seeing some clients, so that helps the practice, you know.
And I think that's probably one of the other differentiators when you are seeking that supervision from someone that you're not necessarily attached to, they're not billing for your time. You are reporting back to the things you're doing. You are sending them videos. They don't have a monetary, either as an individual or as an organization or a small agency, they don't have a monetary stake in your day-to-day activities.
And well, so that's true. I mean, in the schools, you know, that's how it would be. The intern doesn't bill. You know, but they, they do get some payment, but that, you know, it helps the supervisor and that they're giving them some services to help work with children. So,
in particular, that individual, let's say that's not part of a large organization, right, Dr. Katarina?
Yeah.
Their time, if they're supervising this individual, that means they are not working directly with a client to be able to keep their own practice going, right?
Right. So
their decision has to be made. Grow the next individual and be compensated for that, or do I continue to build my caseload with other kids?
And that's why, I mean, some psychologists don't do it, but when they do, it's like 2 hours. What do we have? 8 hours a month or 2 hours a week? You know, so yes. I mean, we don't get compensated. Well, we do get compensated for the board. Yeah, but at a very minimal wage. So, I mean, there are things you do for the profession.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may, I do think the timeline as to when accessibility to funding for behavior analysis matters, I can appreciate that people said, well, as there's more supervisors, then this problem will resolve. But the reality of it is we've only had
streams of funding consistently for about 10 years now. And even that has had some challenges. Even, you know, Arizona as a state recognizing behavior analysts from a billing perspective has really only been since about 2016. So, so accessing revenue as a field has been, has, you know, is still in its infancy. And I think that that plays a part. I do know, you know, when I went to school, and I did an AU's program, and it was around the same time the No Child Left Behind Act had come out and allotted dollars for teachers to go through this positive behavior support program and what have you, but they could only go through the courses. The school incentivized, the government incentivized the going through the courses, but the districts overwhelmingly took the stance of you becoming certified doesn't help us. And what we've seen as a field is sometimes that certification, once they become certified, they end up leaving the schools because the money is better in the private equity insurance world. And so these school districts really don't have a lot of, and this is just one population. Just to give an example, they don't have a lot of incentive for being able to maintain and retain. You know, in school psychology, the hope I would imagine would be that these are going to be your future employment pool. And
the future. But you can't do, you're not supposed to do your internship or practicum at a school where you already work. It has to be a new, it should be a new place. So even that is different.
But it's still, there's still the notion of growing the field for the pool internally. The way with behavior analysts, you know, if you grow someone in the school system, but they go on and change their scope of practice, there's a lot of flexibility there. And so there's risks associated with the cost. I do share similar concerns with potential dual relationships or multiple relationships that could arise. But I do, to Dr. David's point, I also agree that there's mitigating facts in place. I also think that the National Certification Board has continued to move the needle on what's required, all the way down to like how they're defining the client and how they're applying the ethics code. So every couple of years, they become more and more stringent. So I don't know that this is going to always just be a way of the field forever, but I do think that we're with the fact that the revenue streams right now are linked solely to autism services, and there's a lot of private equity money right there. I think it's going to be harder for individuals that want to have a different scope of practice to continue to access supervised experience until we break down some of those other barriers.
I appreciate that. I think one other thing I would just point out is like while we've seen, and Heidi actually has the graphs, but you think about licensure coming online in Arizona 2007, 2008, probably the initial group of us that were licensed were around 50. Maybe we were a little bit higher, lower than that. It's taken us 15 years to get to 700-ish. Even though the last five has been probably the biggest spike, right? And so, I think I kind of hinted at this in my previous comment. Dr. Davis Wilson just said the same. I do think over time, the pay your supervisor will change, and it may be very much a subset of individuals that go through as we see additional funding sources, as we see behavior analysis come more mainstream outside of just autism. And I'll remind you, in the 80s, TBI was, traumatic brain injury was the only way that behavior analysts could actually get paid for services in hospitals or clinical settings. Autism was still, ABA was still considered experimental.
Until they had the Stevens Law, I think, year that was.
Definitely Stevens Law moved it here, as well as then, you know, CMS and excess moving forward. Stevens Law was really around commercial insurance that's regulated only in the state. Very small subset of our population here in Arizona. In fact, most were on state on plans that were not included in that. I mean, I remember first clinic thinking, oh my gosh, we're going to serve hundreds of kids, and scratching our head, 4 months later, and like, where are they? Well, they're all covered under ERISA, which is federally governed, not state governed. They all hit the exclusions of having less than 50 employees, like tons and tons of different things that happen there. But I do think that we're still, psychology has been around around for a lot longer and has had this ability to develop its specialty areas. We're just now starting to see that from the BACB, where we have SIGs and specialty areas in gerontology, environmental sustainability, traumatic brain injury, juvenile justice, and on and on. So I do think we'll get there, and I appreciate the discussion, because I think it's something that, you know, as we talk to individuals that select into self-payment for supervision or agencies that are providing that, that, you know, our discussion needs to be around what are those safeguards, and are you leveraging those safeguards that you're not, you know, you're unwilling to fail somebody because you don't want to lose the $75 for that hour, right? I mean, that's the issue.
Okay, well, thank you for bringing this up. I appreciate it.
No, this is great. Dr. Davis-Wilson, did you have more, or did you just have your hand up?
Oh, I had nothing else.
No, I appreciate the conversation. Hopefully it sheds some light on where we're at and gives you a little bit of confidence that we've come a little ways in 10 years, but you know, we have some ways to go as a field. Thank you. I don't believe there's any action related to that. Yeah. 11. I believe that brings us to item number 1, 2, 3, 4 regarding number 11. 12. And that is going to be agenda items for future meetings. Do I have any requests for such items? Okay, not hearing any. I guess that would be, I think, Ms. Backman. For considering this is future meetings, I think I've got some latitude from Ms. Galvin here. Future meetings, I know we received the email, you know, disappointment that we don't get to be in person today, but I think the caution that you exercised there was probably for the best, given that the potential areas that we could run afoul in open meeting law and the hiccups we were just not confident in. So I want to thank you for making that decision. I'm sure that was not easy, but know that we trust in those decisions and respect your request to push that off for those quote unquote future meetings. If I'm leveraging this item, are we still looking at trying to get together after your confidence grows in the setting and the technology?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So Krishna, Jennifer, and I were in the meeting room, and there were lots of shiny new buttons that we were terrified to start pushing. So, yeah, and you know, we had just to sort of, you know, explain maybe for the public's benefit, we have to take so much into consideration in terms of, you know, capturing a clear recording and, you know, amplifying, you know, the conversation. And, you know, we had some worries about feedback, and, you know, we weren't sure on Wednesday what would change between Wednesday and Friday, because we simply don't control the room, and there is no, we don't even know who the lead or the resource is on all of this new stuff. So what I believe makes sense is that this could be presented again on the July agenda for purposes of choosing, you know, a meeting maybe October timeframe, which affords us plenty of time to, you know, get the training, not be the first board to use the new equipment. We don't want to be that board. We want somebody else to be the guinea pig. But, you know, then we're also past the meetings where Ms. Michelson has sent out notices to parties about their appearances in July, and perhaps there's August involved too. So in our minds, a discussion in July about a possible October meeting, that makes the most sense. And, you know, we could revisit that in July a little bit too.
Okay. Appreciate that. I like how I used my latitude of future meetings there to really press Ms. Galvin to see if she wanted to chime in and tell me I had to be quiet. Thank you for that. Any other items around future meetings? I don't think I heard any. Thank you. Let's go ahead and move to item number 13, and that will be the ever-glorious adjournment of this marvelous meeting.
I move that we adjourn.
Dr. Stewart, I can always count on you for that.
Second,
Dr. Catarino's on fire. All right. any further discussion around this adjournment? I don't hear anybody. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any abstaining? Aye. All right. Any abstaining? Any nays? No. Sounds good. Motion carries. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, board staff. Thank you for those that attended. Sorry this did not get to the four-hour mark for continuing ed, but I assure you there will be agendas in the future where we will definitely hit that four-hour mark. So please stay tuned.
Thank you, Dr. Davey.
Have a great weekend.
Thanks.